Editor's Picks podcast, a monthly discussion with Dr. Nancy Cheshire around featured papers from the current edition of the journal. Welcome to the March 2017 edition of Green Journal Editor's Picks with Dr. Nancy Cheshire, Editor-in-Chief of Obstetrics and Gynecology. I'm John Fisher. Welcome, Dr. Cheshire.
Hey, Dr. Fisher, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. It's January. By the time this comes out, hopefully spring will be on its way and we'll be seeing warmer weather.
I hope so. It's already been too cold for my blood, so I'm ready for March and the robins and frogs and all of that good stuff.
Well, our first paper is by Jerlansky et al. And is entitled Filled Prescriptions for Opioids After Vaginal Delivery. This is a retrospective cohort study of Medicaid-enrolled women in Pennsylvania who delivered a live-born infant vaginally between 2008 and 2017. They excluded women who used opioids during pregnancy or had an opioid use disorder. Of the women that they counted, 12% of the women filled an outpatient opioid prescription 5 days or less after their delivery. Approximately 30% of these patients had what the authors defined as a pain-producing condition, which they used as either tubal ligation, third or fourth degree laceration, or an undergone episiotomy. Additionally, among the women who filled that opioid prescription in the first 5 days, 14% of that number and 1.6% of the total filled a second prescription within the next 6 to 60 days after delivery. Tobacco use during pregnancy, white race, and residing in the southwest part of the state, and then mental health conditions were associated with small but statistically significant increases in filling of a prescription for opioids among women without a pain-producing condition. I think this is a really well-timed paper that increases the focus on our ongoing opioid epidemic and how individuals can become dependent on these substances. While it doesn't tell us if any of the women who filled the prescription became persistent users, it does offer an insight as to the number of women who are potentially at risk to become persistent users. And then they kind of address this, but I was going to ask you, how do we move towards some national guidelines regarding opioids for pain relief after vaginal delivery?
Well, they mention that a little bit because the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, through their Department of Health Services, has put out, I guess, while they were working on this paper, and I would suspect somewhat informed by their data even, possibly, what they refer to as a hierarchical pain management plan that addresses this a little bit as far as the approach to post-vaginal delivery pain, starting with local therapies. I still remember Dr. Doug Miller, when I was a resident, talked about a paper he had written about ice water six baths for episiotomy pain. You know, this was back in the day of high episiotomy rates. And I just could not imagine that anyone would have allowed themselves to be randomly assigned to an ice water six bath. But nonetheless, cold or heat is recommended in this hierarchical pain, as well as, as I recall, topical lidocaine and those sorts of things. And then if that's not working in the hospital, to move up to non-steroidals, assuming that there's not a contraindication to their use, and then only using opioids. And I think those sorts of things, these sorts of recommendations make a lot of sense. As you say, this is very timely with, I think, recently showing a quadrupling in deaths from overdosing, obviously not just from prescription medications, but overall in the last 10 years or so. I may have the time frame incorrect. It may be a shorter time frame than that. But clearly, we as prescribing clinicians need to be very aware of it. They quote a study in this article that horrified me when I read it, that one in 300 women who have had a cesarean section ends up being a persistent user of narcotics based on the narcotic prescriptions that we write for them postoperatively. So the narcotic use post-vaginal delivery, even though it was 12%, I think, in this population that they studied, consistent with some other studies, some percentage of them likely will end up becoming persistent users. one thing that I thought was really interesting, they also talked about the prescription, some specifics about the prescription, which showed that the modal length, I think, was 3 days if you'd taken it around the clock. But some some prescriptions were for as long as 30 days. That's a lot of narcotic.
It is.
To ride out. And I know we all are balancing needs of the postpartum woman who has a new baby who's in pain and has to come and physically pick up a prescription and trying not to make them go through that. We really need to be aware of the risks involved in our prescription writing. So that was a very long answer to a straightforward question. How do we get to a national agreement? I think things like what the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania has put out make sense, and if they can show that that works appropriately, probably should be adopted more broadly. ACOG may have a role to play in this in conjunction with the anesthesiologists. So I think those are things on the national stage that we need to ask for.
Yeah, I think ACOG would probably be a great clearinghouse for something like that. I didn't even thought about the part about having a new mom go fill a prescription for an opioid, but on top of that, she's a new mom taking care of a baby who now is taking opioids and may or may not be impaired, and trying to take care of a new baby at the same time. That's a part to the problem that I think probably needs to be looked at and addressed as well.
Yeah, but we can't ignore the fact that some women go home in a lot of pain.
Sure.
And so I think we need to be very careful that as this pendulum swings back and forth, that we don't overshoot now in the other direction and say, oh, no, I can't write you a prescription for opioids, even though you're sitting there with an agony. We got to take care of the patient. But I think we also need to be much more parsimonious in the way we prescribe these. So I think this is, as you said in the opening of this discussion, a very important paper. I suspect will inform some discussions at the local level in hospitals as to what we're doing and why we're doing it.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think, like you said, we can't let the pendulum swing the other way. It's swung so far to the side of, if you ask for narcotics, we'll give them to you, and our satisfaction scores were based on how well we controlled pain, and there are many issues, I think, that not the least of which is physicians loosened their prescribing habits, but there's many issues that contributed to this problem.
Yeah, and the authors do discuss the AMA's interest in doing away with pain as the fifth vital sign that has perhaps contributed to this. But again, I think that's fine if that's the right answer, but we need to make sure we are taking care of our patients. But narcotics probably not the best approach for the typical patient. I think the good news is, in this population, 88% of people didn't go home with a prescription.
True.
Or didn't fill a prescription. So I think that's probably higher than I would have bet this would data would have shown a few years ago.
Well, our second paper is by Bogis et al. And is entitled Risk Factors for Post-Cesarean Maternal Infection in a Trial of Extended Spectrum Antibiotic Prophylaxis. This is a planned secondary analysis of the randomized controlled trial that was recently published in the New England Journal of Medicine that showed a significant reduction in the risk of post-cesarean surgical site infections with the addition of a single intravenous dose of azithromycin in addition to the standard antibiotic prophylaxis among women undergoing an unscheduled cesarean section. The purpose of this analysis was to identify maternal clinical risk factors for maternal infection. And the authors found that when compared to reference groups, women of black race ethnicity, women who had a non-transverse uterine incision, brain rupture greater than 6 hours and duration of surgery greater than 49 minutes were all associated with higher risks of maternal infection despite the extended antibiotic prophylaxis. I think one of the most interesting points of discussion was that almost 50% of the patients had a BMI of greater than 30, and that among women with a BMI less than 25, there were very few infections. And one of the things I thought about as we're getting ready for our talk is, you know, there are risk factors that we can try to modify, but it seems like many of the risk factors that were here, we just have to kind of accept up front and then try to reduce the infection rate as much as we can.
I agree, and I'm going to make one correction. Dr. Bogus is...
thank you.
...is the way you pronounce that, and it does take a while to get used to that when you get to know Kim. But I think the really important point about this paper is that we need to recall our surgical technique and evidence-based practices to try to limit infections. Antibiotics and a second antibiotic certainly diminish those, and that is part of a evidence-based practice approach to the infection prophylaxis. But as you say, we deal with patients at the time of cesarean section, and their demographics, their characteristics, their labor characteristics at that point are given when we take care of the patient. And what we can modify is our perioperative approach and surgical techniques and such. And so I think that's really the importance of the secondary analysis, is to say, look, azithromycin reduce the infection rate by half as opposed to standard prophylaxis. But now this remaining 6% risk of infection, some of that to be helped with, you know, using sutures instead of staples, using good tissue handling techniques, not exteriorizing the uterus if you can help it, allow the placenta to separate. You know, all those things that we know are evidence-based approaches, we still have to pay attention to. And it was interesting. I had the opportunity to practice obstetrics for a bit in Botswana a little over 8 years ago. And the surgeons that I had the opportunity to operate with, had many of them had come from district hospitals where antibiotics weren't always available. And they didn't have suction. And they didn't have, you know, the latest and greatest suture. Their surgical technique in general was extremely good, and and they had never used a Bovie, for instance. And so just watching people who didn't have the advantages of methods and technologies that those of us who practice in a developed country have, their infection rate was high, but it was in part related also to what we're talking about here, is you have to deal with the patients that you've got when they get there. You know, so ruptured membranes for more than 6 hours is something that stood out here as a risk factor. Well, you know, we're being pushed to induce women more effectively, and that might include artificial ruptured membranes, and then you give them longer in labor, and so we're going to have more women with ruptured membranes for more than 6 hours. That's not necessarily a bad thing. It's just what you got to deal with.
Right.
So, you know, I think that's really the important message.
Mm-hmm.
We still have to be good surgeons.
Oh no, we still do. I think that's kind of the biggest take-home point. The other thing I thought was kind of interesting is that after 49 minutes, they found there was a significant increase in the infection rate. So, redosing much much earlier than what we do in a standard practice may help reduce this infection rate. I think they discussed that it is probably due to the increased plasma volume in pregnancy that is lowering the drug concentrations.
Yeah, and I don't know that anyone's actually done that study yet of randomly assigning women a dose, let's say at an hour or whatever, and seeing if that improves the tissue concentrations. There's been a lot of work done in increasing the initial dose. I haven't seen a paper that looks at redosing sooner than 3 hours. There may be one, I just am not familiar with.
And then just out of curiosity, because I do think this is where we need to go, but what do you think is the impact then in terms of antibiotic stewardship? You know, if we start using more extended spectrum antibiotics in patients, are we going to see an increase in resistance? How do we kind of walk that fine line?
Yeah, they talk about that a little bit, which is that this is just one dose, and of the added azithromycin, and that is unlikely to significantly play a role in emerging resistance. Of course, you know, we don't know that for a fact, but in general, it's, you know, prolonged use of antibiotics that, that increases the resistance. But, you know, it's a trade-off. It's very clearly a trade-off, and I think limiting it to a single dose is one way of going about that. I'll be curious to see, and I'm sure there's work being done on this, as to whether administering probiotics in some form or another perioperatively might help so that the healthy bacteria might, you know, supplant the bad bacteria and somehow change that up. But we're going to learn a lot as the microbiome data comes out. So we'll see. We had a wonderful Grand Rance talk on it, and the use in female pelvic reconstruction.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, there seems to be some data there, but I don't know the results of any trials in women post-cesarean.
Yeah, I don't either. Just in terms of chronic UTIs, there's been some good research that Linda Brubaker's lab has been involved in, looking at the microbiome, the bladder microbiome in women with chronic UTIs, and it's definitely different than other women who don't have that, and then how do you deal with that? So I agree. I think probiotics and looking at the microbiome is going to probably be the next big way to help reduce these infections.
Yeah. Actually, there's a paper in this issue, the March issue, on the microbiome in urinary tract in women with interstitial cystitis. So another paper to kind of take a look at in the March issue.
Well, our last paper is by Zirali et al., and it's entitled Relocation of Obstetrician Gynecologists in the United States, 2005 to 2015. It's a longitudinal descriptive study that analyzed relocation patterns of OBGYNs over the 10 years between 2005 and 2015. They found that approximately every year, approximately 6.5 of what was on average 37,000 practicing OBGYNs moved in that year. And then over the course of the study, it added up to about one-third of active OBGYNs relocated once or twice, but more than half of them remained in their state. OBGYNs who relocated were more likely to be young, male, black, or an international medical graduate. And then relocations were predominantly, they looked at this by county, predominantly to counties that were either urban or with a lower percentage of the population in poverty. A couple of factoids I found that were interesting in this was that while the number of OBGYNs in women 18 years or older has increased in most states, the ratio of women to practicing OBGYNs has actually increased from one woman per 3,155 OBGYNs in 2006 to only one woman to 3,293 in 2015, speaking to the fact that we probably need more OBGYNs across the country. It's just that we're concentrated incorrectly. The states that gained most were Florida, California, and Washington, while their losses were concentrated in Michigan, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Illinois, and New York. So some of the theories I thought that were kind of interesting looking at this is that, well, physicians are just following similar pattern shifts in the general population, which does seem to be true. You know, from the Northeast to Texas, the West, and Florida, do you have any thoughts as to what may be driving this as well?
Well, they comment also on malpractice issues, and certainly some of the states that are losing obstetricians in their study are high-risk malpractice states, and so that may play a part of it. In Pennsylvania and New York and Ohio, my understandings are those are some of the high malpractice areas. So that might be part of it. The movement to the warmer climates may in part be, as they said, just the regular, what's happening to the rest of the population. But it is interesting that Florida for a long time has had problems of not having obstetrician gynecologists, and then to see that that's been a place where there's been a gain is actually quite interesting to me. Whether that's because there's been a void and so there's heavy recruiting going on or exactly what is kind of an interesting question. The other things that are in here, though, is that they talk about is that for the men who are more likely to move, and again, a lot of these are fairly small numbers, fairly small differences, but it might be that they didn't get their first choice in their practice to begin with. That's been documented as a difference in the past for men versus women obstetrician gynecologists when they leave residency, women being more likely to get their first choice in their practice. Men might have not gotten their first choice to begin with, and thus, more likely to move if that was not a good fit for them. Or that men might be partnered more commonly with women who either have a mobile career or don't work outside the home, for instance, and might be easier to move. It didn't surprise me that the older individuals or the people that they documented that just practiced gynecology, that they did not move as commonly.
Right.
They tend to be set in their communities, have an established practice. It's hard to start up a new practice and those sorts of things. And people who just do gynecology are more likely to be older individuals. And so that part of this didn't shock me too much. The authors do start with the question of how do you define workforce issues, which I thought was a really important one, and which is around adequacy, which is the number of doctors per patient that you discussed, as well as the appropriate training and the right size overall, the composition, whether there's a diversity in the workforce, and that would also contribute to distribution, so both the specialty distribution and the geographic distribution. So this paper really only addresses the geographic distribution to any large degree, although they touch on the adequacy thing as a potential solution.
Right.
I don't know how this will play with policy. I mean, paying back loans has certainly been tried to get physicians to work in rural or underserved areas, and that may be part of this, as well as the people who complete their loan payback, maybe they're at that point then moving to what they perceive as a more desirable place to live. So they've documented this. I don't know precisely what can be done about it, except for at large scale policy decisions.
Yeah, really good information. I mean, it can certainly make a huge impact when they talk about how, half of all U.S. counties lack a single OBGYN.
Yeah. That was a stunning.
Yeah, it was very stunning for me. I spent 3 years in Idaho as a flight surgeon, and there were small towns in Idaho that would have one family practice doc who could never take a vacation. He was on 365 every year. Well, Dr. Cheshire, thank you again for another enlightening discussion about this month's articles.
Absolutely.
Look forward to talking to you again in April.
Fantastic. Have a wonderful rest of your January.
You too. Thank you for listening to Green Journal Editor's Picks. As always, we appreciate your feedback. Please contact me at jfischer, that's J-F-I-S-C-H-E-R, at greenjournal.org, with your comments, suggestions, or questions that I can ask Dr. Cheshire for our next edition. Have a great day!